Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to composer Jerzcan Fendrix, where we chat about his work on Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things.
I do just have to congratulate you on such a feat of a film. I've been so fortunate to have seen it twice now, and there's just always something new to unpack at each screening, and it's just such, I mean, it's just whimsical, it's fantastical, it's just absolutely lovely, and I just have to congratulate you on, I mean, such a towering achievement, your first feature film.
Sure. Thanks very much. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we're all very proud of it. I think we're feeling good about it.
And so I'm curious what it was like meeting Yorgos for the first time.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, very out of the blue, basically, during one of the later lockdowns, I got an email saying that he'd listened to an album I'd released a year before that, during the first lockdown. And that was just an album of pop songs, didn't really sound anything like a film score. And it just said that he wanted to have a conversation. And he was happened to be in London at that point. So we met in a park in public, and it was kind of raining very torrentially. And we both kind of decided we were going to ignore it and just sat in this park and just chatted for a while about the whole thing and what it could, you know, look like, and the script and the designs and everything. So it was very unexpected, to be honest, but very fortunate.
And were you familiar with his work prior to hearing about Poor Things?
I was familiar, yeah. I was, actually. And I thought, you know, he's an incredibly, you know, yeah, I thought he was a really great filmmaker. And I'd seen all of the stuff. And actually, I think I'd written something vaguely about the music used in The Lobster at university. And yeah, it's funny. The first email I got from his producers was basically, you know, we work for this guy. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's familiar with yours, which was a bit of a, like, you know, oh, fuck kind of thing. But yeah.
I love that. And I love that you read about The Lobster in your university work. That's fantastic. I think it's well known at this point now that, I mean, Yorgos hasn't used a composer on some of his previous projects. And I mean, was that a daunting task that sort of presented in front of you, or was that a ready-made challenge that you were just intrigued to just dive in and sort of get into this world that he's created?
Yeah, I mean, I think not having done a film before, if he had worked with a series of very impressive composers and then decided to go with me, that would have probably been more intimidating, because he would have known how much I could fuck it up. But he was also completely new to the process as well. So we were both kind of, you know, not entirely sure what we were doing and just kind of working it out, basically. And I think that neither of us really knew what the correct thing to do was. So we did things that other people, you know, other directors and composers wouldn't have really thought was acceptable in terms of film music. And that's probably a good thing in the context of this film.
I agree 100%. And so I'm just curious, where in the process were you brought into?
I was brought in about 6 months before principal photography, so no filming had been done. Most of the score was written and produced, basically, by the time that filming started. So I was just working off of the script, and I was working off of the artistic designs, or the set designs, or the costume designs, or the props, concept art, stuff like that. So there was a lot of time and there was a lot of space not to be encumbered by a visual or you know, a time limit or a functional necessity. I was basically just thinking very deeply about all of the story and writing music based on how I felt about it and what I thought was emotionally pertinent.
And what were some of those initial elements that popped out for you in regards to maybe creating some of the overarching themes of the film?
Yeah, I think very early on, one decision was based on Bella's character and how unusual it was to have someone in her position to have so much development and to start from such a bizarre infantile point and to go to this, you know, basically superhuman level. So what we really wanted, what I really thought was appropriate, is not having a score, especially at the beginning, that was kind of too polished, too nice, too kind of sexy. It really needed to be vulnerable and kind of yeah, emotionally it's almost embarrassing. And kind of when she's developing and she's kind of falling around a bit, she doesn't really know how to interact, and it kind of had to have that wobble and uncertainty and honesty to it. And even as the score develops with her and, you know, with her experiences, it gains more control and more complexity and color. It still always has that sense of not adhering to what the score should be. It always is kind of a bit more brutally honest than it kind of should be. So that was an early idea.
And I mean, just sort of going along the various trips that Bella and Duncan start taking, I'm just curious in terms of, I mean, those different locations where you drew inspiration. Was it from I mean, the cities that they were going to? Was it the sets? Was it the costumes that you were seeing? Or was it a combination of sort of a multitude of other things?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there is a bunch of diegetic music, which to some extent has to be grounded in these quite fictionalized versions of existent countries. So the dance scene in Lisbon was kind of this mutation of a lot of Portuguese folk research I was doing. But at the core of it was less to do with kind of being like, oh, in this country, here's a motif on this country's instrument. As you often get, it was really more to do with the psychological interior and, you know, was she experiencing wonder? Was she experiencing fear? Did she suddenly have a purpose? Especially, I think the most obvious example of this is when she arrives in Alexandria and is, for the first time, is ex you know, experiences true horror, and I, you know, basically needed something that matched how she was feeling, something like really just, you know, completely just pure anguish, and it was basically just a scream musically. It didn't, you know, I didn't want it just to be a kind of like nice dramatic cue for that bit. It really wanted to be like howling and sobbing and difficult to listen to because it would have been difficult to experience. So yeah, that was more of the impetus really for the new locations.
I love that. And I mean, sort of going into that moment, I mean, were there any particular influences that you were drawing from in terms of, I mean, just despair and horror in previous works or in previous just I don't know. I'm curious to where you sort of ground horror.
Yeah, I mean, another thing Yorgos and I agreed very early on is that we would never discuss any other music. We would never discuss any other films, any other composers, whatever. There was no temp music. There was no pack of references. So everything really organically had to derive from the world of the film. So yeah, no influences like that. I mean, I think, I don't know, I was definitely influenced by stuff like, I don't know, jokes or smells. did a lot of medical research in the early stages. There's a really great medical library called the Wellcome Collection that has a lot of historic medical documents from around this time period. And I spent a lot of time thinking how I could make the jump abstractly to what sort of procedures they were doing then, to what sort of procedures I could do on the instruments. But no traditional influences deliberately.
Mm. And I mean, just in terms of the process, I mean, it doesn't sound like it was very much traditional. So I'm just curious, was sort of taking apart each piece less traditional? I mean, granted, this is the first feature, but I mean, was each approach different in terms of process?
Not particularly. Towards the end, there were a couple of scenes where I hadn't written anything that seemed appropriate yet, so I was put in a very different position of actually seeing if I could match. But 95-98% of the music was basically just me reacting to all this information and all this emotion, and then generally through conversation with Yorgos working out where to stick them. But it was a very abstract way of composing. It felt a lot less technical than I was anticipating, because I was basically able to write freely. And then I think actually a lot of the performances and a lot of the editing ended up slightly molding around some of the pieces of music rather than the other way around.
Mm. And I'm curious, diving into, I think my favorite character outside of Bella would be Duncan. And I'm just curious what some of the reactions you were, I mean, because he's much more comical, he's much more flamboyant, out there, very boisterous. And so I'm curious if those were sort of some of the themes you were picking up from him, or if it was something else that sort of gravitated for you.
Yeah, Duncan's great. I really like Duncan. Ultimately, like, as a character, the conceit is he's basically futile, which I really love. Musically, I liked establishing that early on. There's a theme, which is the first theme that's played in the film. It's these four notes on very high violins. And that is kind of associated with Bella's previous life as Victoria, and it kind of comes in at different points in the film, and a lot of the time you can't really hear it. It's kind of underneath other stuff, and then it's only once you get this big kind of shocking twist at the end and you see her life before and you feel that, where it really comes in, that becomes very, it's very stark and piercing. And I think it's probably some of the scariest music in the film. And as a contrast, Duncan's music, when you first see him, it's basically a version of that, but it's a bit more, it's slightly more anodyne, it's a bit less centered. It's like, and I think there's definitely a sense that he's meant to be a threat, but also trying to convey that actually what Bella's already subconsciously experienced is so much more powerful that basically he can't really do anything to hurt her. That's a weird way around of explaining it, but that's kind of how I felt about scoring Duncan. But no, most of the time, I think Bella's music kind of takes precedent over him. It drowns him out.
Mm. And was there another character, just to ask you, that intrigued you the most or was exciting? I mean, obviously they're all exciting to write for, but if there was just a particular person that stuck out for you, and maybe it's someone that's less known.
I think I really love Max McCandless. I think he's a gorgeous character. I think Rami played him in such an interesting way and almost kind of, you know, made him seem very much like a contemporary London boy. And I was really moved by him, and I was really moved by his relationship with Bella. He seems to basically have one of the only, you know, one of the most blameless and pure and honest relationships with Bella throughout the film. So where he is starting to kind of fall in love with her a bit, and they're starting to understand each other like that, when he asks her to marry him, there's a piece I wrote for both of them, which is just like a very small, very high-pitched voice singing and like a little bell that moves. I think it's the cutest piece of music in the film. I feel very warmly towards that because I feel so warmly to both of those characters and their relationship. So I was, yeah, that really struck me, and I love, yeah, I still have very paternal feelings for that cute. Then at the other end of the spectrum, Alfred Blessington, the general, the first husband, I think is actually so much of the threat of the men through the film is almost a bit farcical. And then you have someone who's, you know, comes along who's actually seeking to physically mutilate her. And I that section in his house, there's so much less whimsy, and that's actually like, oh, like this is something really cold and really stark. And I was, it was really interesting playing with stuff there where I wanted to actually get this, you know, very unadorned sense of fear. And this, and basically someone who had offered something so awful that she chose it to kill herself. And that marked a really stark contrast in the music and how powerful and how awful it had to be.
And I mean, speaking of maybe one of the only sort of motherly roles in the film, I mean, you have Catherine Hunter's lovely sort of, I don't know exactly how to describe her character's bio, but sort of the lady of the parlor, I guess you could say. And I'm just curious what you were able to play with there, because I just think she delivers such a wonderful little performance that I can't stop thinking about. She always, every single time I see her on screen, I'm completely taken aback by what she's able to do. So just curious, just for my own sake, if there was anything
Yeah.
there.
Yeah, no, that performance is so wonderful. Like I got to see this performance so many times over and over again during the editing process. And like she is, you know, such an extraordinary actor. It's a real joy to see her perform over and over again. I think her role, and it's slightly underrated, is Bella's been like learning and amassing all this information and this weaponry up until this point. And she's the first person, I think, who's really like, okay, like you have a purpose. You know you have a purpose. You're about to follow it tooth and nail. And the main piece of music that happens during the Paris sequence is, I think, you know, after this horrifying realization in Alexandria, it has this like momentum and this sense of like, okay, I know what I'm going to do with all this stuff now. I know where I'm going to go. I have control. And it's basically the first really fully formed, fully in control piece of music. So yeah, I think that's a great gift that Catherine's character gives to Bella.
And I'm curious what it was like working with the sound team, because it flows so I mean, it just, you hit that perfect line in terms of the effortlessness of it. And I'm curious what it was like working with Johnny Byrne and his team.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, Johnny Byrne is a phenomenal sound designer, and I think we think very similarly again about doing stuff you're not meant to do. So it's, yeah, it's so much fun at the final stages of the film, kind of working out how everything fit together. Something he said actually, because you know he's done a few phenomenal films, but I think there were parts of the score for Poor Things that were very, very bare and unadorned, like not really any reverb or anything, like kind of very stark and singular. And he is saying, like, you know, there's a lot of scenes where if I was just given the scene, usually I'd, you know, try and get this nice lush atmosphere of street sounds and different effects and so on. And I think in response to the score being so stark, and kind of disarmingly bare, he basically took away quite a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, the score only has what's completely necessary and nothing else. So a lot of the scenes I think are actually, there's a lot of space and a lot of quietness in order to match that sort of feeling. And in other areas, obviously there's a huge amount of noise and they kind of play with each other to have this, you know, really overwhelming sense of volume. So I don't know. But anyway, working with Johnny, great. Love it.
And I mean, is was there a, I mean, there's probably 100 unexpected challenges that you get on a project like this. But I'm curious for you, maybe if there's one that you can pinpoint that there you just didn't expect to have happen.
Yeah, I mean, this could have been an easier process. I put most of the challenges on myself, to be honest. I keep saying we. Anyway, the one decision was to be able to have this total control over all the instrumental sounds and be able to surgically alter them and butcher them and fuck with them, which meant we had to record every single instrument separately. And if there was a string section of like 30 violins or something, then each one had to go separately. And there was never really an ensemble in a room. So the recording and production process was actually very complicated, a lot more complicated than it would have been traditionally. And this was kind of necessary so we could actually go into complete detail on every sound and alter it for various reasons and for various effects. But that obviously takes a great deal of logistical strain and time to sort out. But yeah, that feels like the most obviously challenging thing. Also, it's just such a huge film and there are so many locations. Like, it's not a bottle, it's like the opposite of a bottle film. So the amount of material and development and story that the music has to cover means that, so much, so many themes, so much music had to be available to accompany this journey. But it's great. I could have written twice as much if I had the time. It's like it's an endlessly inspiring source of source of inspiration.
And just maybe a more fun question for you. Where do you think
These are all
Bella is?
fun.
But where do you think Bella Baxter is? Well, obviously she's probably dead today. But where do you think after we sort of see her in her penultimate state, not to give anything away, but where do you think she's running around?
I don't know. It'd be nice if she visited Glasgow at some point. I was thinking a great deal. I have some Scottish heritage, and like I think it's a good idea for the film to be set in London, but I think Scottishness is very key to the thing. So yeah, maybe she goes to Glasgow and does some stuff up there. There's beautiful medical schools up there to teach in. Great city. Yeah, maybe they all move to Scotland and it's great.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And then, I mean, final question for you. Well, I guess final two-part question for you. What do you take away from working on this project? And then, I mean, what do you hope that audiences ultimately take away from a project like this? Maybe not as much the messaging around the film in terms of the feminist nature of it all, but maybe just about filmmaking in general and what you guys were able to accomplish just as a team.
Oh, sure, interesting. Well, I mean, I've had the benefit of having seen this film so many times, and it really hasn't got boring yet. And I've got to think a huge amount about it as a result. Personally, the thing I've landed on is the way in which it depicts development, the different ways people can develop, and you reflect on the ways in which you've developed, you've grown up, or things have changed in your life. And also a lot of the different characters who aren't Bella, like Duncan and God and so on, it's put into such stark, almost like a morality play, it's put into such stark contrast, like where the deficiencies are, or where the development ended, or where it's been stunted in some regard. So the whole idea about how you change and evolve as a person and what can impede that for me is the thing that I've really reflected on the most philosophically. As a piece of art, I think, I'm in complete agreement with every other person who's, been in charge of an aspect of this film. We've all been given the freedom to go as far as we want, really. And I can't point to any examples of when me or the production designers or the costume designers or the actors have been told to tone it down at all. And it's kind of coincidental to sort of the message of the film, I suppose. But there's a lot, I think there are so many works of art where people do what they think they should be doing or what they think they're expected to do, and they kind of limit themselves in that sense. And I think the film's such a great testament to what happens if you just do what you want and you push it as far as you and don't worry about the general concerns and inhibitions of, or the imagined concerns and inhibitions of other people and other bodies. And I think you can really see in the film that there's like so much freedom and pushing that I think is actually quite special.
Absolutely. And what a perfect way to cap this off. But Triskin, I want to thank you so much for the time and the candor, and I mean just the work in general. It's truly awe-inspiring, and obviously I can't stop thinking about it since I saw it about a month ago, and I probably won't be able to stop thinking about it long past its release. But really, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Sure. No, it's been lovely to chat to you, Jackson. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery, but a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.